This is an I Am Listening original podcast.
London wants to keep building offices and not build housing. So we have to house the overspill from London, which means that the houses that get built are aimed at the London market, and our locals are struggling to get on the housing ladder, even though there's all these houses going up. It's an absolutely chronic situation.
Welcome to the Kent Politics Podcast, your go-to source for insightful discussions on local and national political matters. Join us as we take a deep dive into local government across the county. Find out what the key decision makers have to say, what your money is being spent on, and how the party's policies could affect how we live. Plus, don't miss our regular feature, Westminster Watch, where we dissect the latest developments and decisions shaping the political landscape in the heart of the UK's capital. Engage with us as we delve into the issues that matter to you and explore the dynamic world of politics from a Kent perspective.
Welcome to the Kent Politics Podcast. In a week that the controversial Chatham Dock scheme was recommended for approval, Whitstable residents got an idea of what's in store in the local plan, and we discuss whether the government's Rwanda policy will make a difference. I'm Kent County Council local democracy reporter Simon Finlay, and I'm joined by Medway Council reporter Robert Boddy.
Hello.
And Dan Essen, who covers the borough and district councils.
Hello.
We'll also be speaking to political editor Paul Francis about the week in Westminster. And myself and Dan will be speaking to our special guest, Councillor Mike Baldock, the former leader of Swale Council, who leads the Swale Independent Alliance Group. But before we crack on, though, just to mention that we're recording this podcast before the local and police and crime commissioner elections. That means by the time you hear this, the votes will all have been cast. For the latest on what's happening in Kent, visit Kent Online for a comprehensive coverage. OK, first up is Robert. What's been happening?
Well, the big moment this week in Medway is kind of a half moment, really, in the sense that this week, planning documents were released showing that Medway Council officers are recommending approval for the controversial Chatham Docks Basin 3 redevelopment, which would see the closure of the working port, demolition of the current warehouses, relocation of the businesses there in favour of a new business campus by Peel Waters.
Mm. Does that mean that the Chatham Docks will have to close?
Not necessarily. So this is a recommendation by officers. The decision will actually be made at the next planning meeting on Wednesday, May the 8th. And that will be the real decision as far as Medway Council is concerned. However, if councillors do agree with the officers' recommendations, members of the Save Chatham Docks campaign have told me that they will try whatever they can, including going to the National Planning Inspectorate to try and reverse the decision.
Mm, well, that's very interesting. Thanks very much, Robert. Dan, so what's been happening at borough and district level?
So I've yet again been up to my eyes in local planning. I went to a public consultation meeting in Whitstable last week, where locals were told about how Canterbury City Council's local plan is going to affect the town.
What sort of changes might Whitstable see under the local plan then?
So as it stands under Canterbury City Council's local plan, Whitstable will get another 3,750 homes or thereabouts around the town. The council's held quite a few public consultation meetings around the district on this, in Whitstable, Herne Bay and Canterbury. But the one I was at in Whitstable got pretty heated.
Well, how on earth does a local plan meeting get so heated?
Well, so it started with council officers giving a presentation of about 45 minutes explaining the sort of bureaucracy of the plans, how they'll affect Whitstable, the process going forward, how they'll take residents' comments into account and that kind of thing. But once that was over, public participation started, which was just over an hour, and it was pretty much non-stop from there. As you might expect, the room was pretty much entirely filled with people who object either in part or in whole to any plans for new house building in Whitstable. And every single person who spoke, without exception, made clear that they thought the volume of homes proposed was too much. The meeting got gradually less civil with plenty of heckling, people telling council officers that they thought everything was predetermined and that the council officers didn't know what they were on about. Some people were even straight up arguing that Canterbury City Council should simply refuse to build the number of homes that the national government says it has to. The council has to take into account feedback from the public, but they certainly can't do that.
Okay, thank you very much, Dan.
So, Simon, what's been going on at County Hall this week?
It's been a quiet week at County Hall again. We're still just coming out of Easter. It has emerged that Kent County Council has been hit by multiple cyber attacks and forced to pay out thousands of pounds in compensation for data breaches. This vulnerability in KCC has been revealed by a company under the Freedom of Information legislation. It turns out the KCC has been targeted by hackers 13 times in the last 3 years and suffered nearly 2,500 instances of personal data being stolen or accessed without authorisation. And it's also revealed that the council has paid out about £16,000 in compensation for an unspecified number of data breaches.
So how did this come to light? Did you say it was through Freedom of Information?
The breaches came to light when a private company called databreachclaims.org.uk issued some FOI requests to various new local authorities in the UK. But to put it in, it should be put into some sort of context, because cyber breaches are being reported across pretty much all local authorities, health authorities and the like, as well as large corporations. This was once big news a few years ago, but it barely gets a mention these days.
And who's likely behind these attacks?
Well, most cybercrime, you know, there'll be criminal groups across the world trying to access personal data using phishing techniques, where staffers at organisations like KCC might inadvertently click on an email and allow the threat actors into the system. Some will use so-called ransomware to try and extract massive cash or money from organisations, or there's no evidence that actually happened in the case of KCC.
And what did KCC have to say about all this?
He said that all KCC has been able to demonstrate that its processes and general mitigations against cyber attacks are pretty sound. And KCC, like all big organisations, is constantly vigilant about the threat of cybercrime and updating its methods of counteracting it. The bigger the organisation, the more vulnerable it is, I guess. But it's a never-ending battle, and while some may be shocked by what has happened, it's very much at the lower end of the scale as far as KCC is concerned. Right, we're going to turn our attention now to international story, which involves Kent every day of the week, it seems. The subject of migration, immigration and Rwanda is never far from the top of the news agenda. And this week we learned that the first voluntary mover to Rwanda was on Monday, when a failed asylum seeker flew there with £3,000 of taxpayers' cash in his pocket. The government hopes to start forced removals in the coming months. But is the policy an electoral winner, or a massive waste of funds, and which could be better spent? What do you reckon then, Dan?
So, first, I think it's important to put in context that this isn't the first attempt by, or proposal by, British government to solve the immigration, or at least the illegal immigration problem, by putting illegal immigrants elsewhere. In the late 90s and 2000s, there were, you know, the Telegraph recently revealed there were proposals by Tony Blair aides to basically house refugees and asylum seekers in Scotland. In, if I remember right, the 2010s, there were proposals to put them even further away in Ascension Island, which is part of a British overseas territory in the South Atlantic, proper middle of nowhere. None of those came to fruition. This is the first such plan to actually, you know, get particularly far. And obviously Rwanda has a bit of a history of this. It takes illegal immigrants for a lot of other countries as well. I think Israel at one point had to deal with them to host people who illegally entered Israel. But I mean, realistically, like, it's not going to help the Conservatives polling. You know, we'll start is because it's unlikely to actually work. Mm. And secondly, because the
It's the whole asylum thing has been really sort of with us for more than three decades. Remember Michael Howard saying to me back in the 1990s, he said that his famous line was, when I was Home Secretary, asylum cases fell by 40%. But, and then we find that Tony Blair, which was sort of around about the time when he was in the shadow cabinet, it was a problem then. And it really hasn't gone away. It just seems to sort of like, it seems to sort of like fade away for a little while, and then something else emerges.
No, and the public interest on immigration isn't just illegal immigration. Numbers of people arriving illegally are, you know, relatively minimal compared to legal migration. You know, net migration last year was something, you know, just under 700,000, when, you know, every government which has won an election in this country since the 90s has been elected on a promise of reducing immigration, and under every single one of those governments, immigration has increased.
I think the thing that a lot of people are talking about in relation to this Rwanda scheme is just the eye-watering cost. I mean, just by the end of 2023, when they hadn't even sent anybody, the government had already spent £240 million on Rwanda. I mean, over the next 5 years, it's going to cost at least £370 million. These are huge amounts of money, and a lot of this has been without sending anybody apart from one volunteer asylum seeker who has gone this week. Is that right?
That's correct, yeah. So, Paul, what's your take on it from your Westminster perspective?
Well, politically, it's an issue which vexes all the main parties. And I think Labour's difficulty is that no one really knows what its plans would be if it gets into power. Now, it has said that it will recruit 1,000 extra caseworkers to deal with the backlog of asylum seekers. But beyond that, not really terribly much detail about what it intends.
They said they're going to smash the gangs and they're going to, you know, go upstream.
Thing
upstream.
Yes, this notion of safe routes has been talked about quite a bit, along with, as you say, Simon, the busting of gangs who are smuggling people across the channel. Now, I think the difficulty there is that There's no compulsion on France to join any agreement with us about that kind of action at all, because we're now no longer part of the EU. And I think this is an issue which serves both sides of the arguments around staying in and staying out.
The Home Office has been spending quite a lot of money on advertising, I think, haven't they, Dan?
Yes, the Home Office has spent quite a lot of money. I think it was about £500,000 worth on essentially marketing campaigns to sort of dissuade people from coming to the UK, with a specific focus on people. Focus on people from Vietnam and Albania. Something I read in an article a little while ago was that the British government managed to reduce the number of people coming from Albania by establishing an agreement with the Albanian government to immediately deport people. But part of their program to discourage sort of further attempts by Albanian nationals to come here illegally was the UK government paying, you know, influencers, and specifically Albanian-speaking influencers, to make TikToks discouraging people from coming to the UK. I didn't know this, but apparently this was common in Albania, that people who went from Albania to Britain sort of promoting their life in Britain on social media was actually apparently quite a big draw for people coming to this country. So the Home Office obviously cottoned onto that and tried to dissuade it.
And one of the countries or an increasing number of people are coming in from is Vietnam, but I can't see maybe that particular mode of dissuasion would work in the same way, because people come from these different countries for all sorts of different reasons, and they're smuggled by different types of gangs. They all appear to sort of end up in the same place, but it's a much more nuanced, much more complex picture, and it can't just be sort of solved by TikTok necessarily.
I think the Albania example is a really a key one, in the sense of it is probably the most successful element of the government cracking down on illegal immigration with the return scheme with Albania. And I believe they're trying to do something similar with Vietnam. This sort of Rwanda scheme seems like, to me, sort of the opposite direction. It's not really going anywhere. The return schemes of Albania and possibly what they're working on with Vietnam seems the real place to go. But I think also, you know, the small boats element of this, I mean, people wouldn't be surprised. It's a relatively new problem. I think you were citing earlier, Simon, that pre-boats, it was lorries was the big problem, and Border Force really cracked down and got into basically solving that specific problem. And the reason why we have this influx of boats now is because it's much harder. They use drones, and they used, I think, CO2 detectors and things like that to find where people were in the lorries. And now boats is the only really viable option to get across the channel these days.
Well, it makes you wonder that should the boats be stopped through whatever means, be it smashing the gangs or smashing the manufacturers of the boats themselves, whatever it is, or you disrupt the activities of the gangs, if the small boats issues sort of fade away, as most of these sort of like methods eventually do, what will come in its place? Because nothing's ever worked in the past. So that would be my question, is that should they actually solve it, what happens next?
Is there a topic that you would like to be discussed on the Kent Politics Podcast? Perhaps you've got a question for one of our panel, or you'd like to comment on a hot topic in local or national government. Get in touch by emailing or sending a voice note to kentpoliticspodcast@thekmgroup.co.uk.
Now we'll speak to Paul Francis with his Westminster Watch. What's been going on then, Paul?
Well, it's been something of a landmark week for the government on the long-awaited implementation of new biosecurity checks for imported food products and other goods. This comes after 5 delays, and the new post-Brexit regime came into force, with Kent centre stage amid complaints that the arrangements are adding to businesses' costs. Now, the controversy has also been around the decision by the government not to use Dover as a point at which these checks will be made, but to move them 22 miles away inland to a site at Savington near Ashford, which would do the bulk of the work, which has inevitably invited the question of whether less scrupulous operators will simply ignore the instruction to check in at Savington and drive off in the direction of somewhere else.
That's an enormous site, that. Is that the one I'm thinking of, which is sort of lit up a bit like a open plan prison? It's huge.
Yes, it's huge, and it looks a bit like Wembley Stadium at night time when there's a match going on, but leading to all sorts of complaints about light pollution, less traffic. Now, obviously, the advantage here is that it's such a site that it can accommodate the numbers coming through to have their goods checked, etc. But the industry, the food industry in particular, is worried about the extra costs. It has to pay something like £145 registration fee every consignment that it brings in. And who will pick up the bill? Well, you guessed it, that will probably be us.
Yeah, because there was a guy on the telly the other night, and I think he was running a garden centre, so a lot of the stuff, the plants that they're getting come in from abroad, and they reckon it was going to cost about £20,000 a year just to bring in the stuff that he would normally bring in, and clearly that's only going to go one way in terms of the cost. He either sucks it up and you know, doesn't hand it on to the buyers, but clearly that's probably what is going to happen.
Yeah, I think that's a similar theme across all parts of the food industry. There's something called the Cold Food Federation, I think, who have suggested that the extra costs in total for operators coming through the Port of Dover will be an additional £1 billion. Now, I don't know how they calculate these figures, but they're obviously worried about having to pass on some of these costs and finding that they lose custom as a result.
Okay, but this is obviously got a this is obviously going to fall onto the plate of our local MPs, especially the ones that are in South Kent and Ashford. I mean, what's been the fallout?
Well, as you can imagine, in Ashford, the MP Damian Green is relatively happy about the use and says that everything's in order and the checks will go very smoothly, and he's quite happy to use that site. Completely the opposite view of Natalie Elphick, the MP for Dover, who's very annoyed at the fact that the government has decided to move these checks to the Sevington site when there is a state-of-the-art, newly equipped checking centre at Dover, which is where you would automatically think checks ought to be made to stop perhaps the less scrupulous operators making their escape.
So, I mean, why have they, if that's the case, why are they insisting that people go 22 miles up the road to Sevington?
Well, I think it's a capacity issue more than anything. The government believes that most operators will abide by the legislation and regulations on checks, and therefore travelling an extra 22 miles from Dover to Ashford is not really of any consequence, because they will do what they're supposed to do.
Listen, Paul, thank you very much indeed for joining us again, and we'll speak to you next week.
Okay, see you next week.
Our special guest this week was previously the leader of Swale Borough Council, spearheading the so-called Rainbow Coalition. He was the authority's deputy leader until December this year, when he resigned, saying he was unable to work with the Labour group any longer. Mike Baldock joins us now. How are you doing, Mike?
I'm good.
Thanks for coming in. Much appreciated. You've been around the political block a bit. Can you just sort of talk about your sort of entrance into politics?
Well, how long have you got? In the 80s, I joined the Young Liberals, and I still think their manifesto or their platform is one of the best that has ever been seen. I wasn't too happy with the merger. I sort of drifted out, joined the Greens late 90s and stayed with them for a few years. But a lot of it was when I was moving. So when I moved from Chatham, I left the Greens. I was a bit fed up with the way that at the time the Greens just seemed to campaign by gimmick rather than doing serious door-to-door knocking and canvassing and working an area. I was out of politics for a while. I joined Labour in 2004 mainly to try and stop the Conservatives winning the local seat. I left Labour late 2009 after the surrender of Lisbon, checked out UKIP for a while before joining them, when once I'd realised that, you know, the scare stories weren't true. quite successful with UKIP. We got some good policies together for local government. Had a bit of success in Kent and on Swale, and then Gerard Batten took over UKIP, and it became obviously a party that was going nowhere on a platform that nobody was interested in. It was horrendous, so I left. And for the 2019 local elections, I set up an alliance of local independents. We did well in 2019, and that's where I'm happy as an independent.
Okay. And someone told me, actually, I don't know whether this is true or not, but you worked as a sort of advisor to Tony Blair, is that correct?
Not advisor, no. I used to work in Downing Street. If you wrote a letter to the Prime Minister, you had a 1 in 8 chance of getting a reply from me, which might be disappointing.
So what was your job then?
I was in the Direct Communications Unit.
Okay. And what did you do day-to-day apart from answering letters?
Answering letters.
That was your job, yeah. Okay.
I mean, that was massive. I mean, it was during the time of 9/11. So we had to weed out the slightly weirder letters and make sure everybody got a decent response, forward them to the right department. Sometimes we dealt with ministerial work. So, yeah, it was interesting.
If you were in comms, were you working under the iron fist of Alistair Campbell by any chance?
No, because that was more Labour Party. You were in the government side. And there's always this very, very tight rope to walk between the two. And I'm not sure everybody stayed on the right side of the rope all the time. But Alistair Campbell was Labour. I was Prime Minister. Government.
Okay. You're going to be standing for Sittingbourne and Sheppey at the general election as an independent.
A Swale independent,
beg your pardon. How do you rate your chances? Can you make a significant difference to the actual result, perhaps, even if you don't win?
I think it's all up in the air at the moment. I mean, there's a lot of disillusion with the main parties. There's a lot of candidates locally who are standing in Sittingbourne Sheppey who aren't really local, haven't got a local background. I think that one of the big issues in Sittingbourne Sheppey is the amount of housing that's being foisted upon us, and none of the other three parties, Labour, Lib Dem, Tory, are proposing to reduce that, and the Conservative government have at least removed some of the requirement to follow a target. But everything you read about the others indicates that they're going to put the targets on even higher. A lot of people are looking to reform as an alternative. I don't think they realise just how hyper-driven the housing market would be under reform. So that will be one of my selling points. And the fact that I've lived in the area for a long time, as politicians go, a relatively high profile, and I really care about the area. So I'm hoping that it will impact on the debate in Sittingbourne and Sheppey, and that we'll get away from some of the more highfalutin issues and actually focus on what's going to affect the people of Sittingbourne and Sheppey.
There is a sea change on the way, it appears.
Oh, nationally, there's no doubt Labour will win. It's just what sort of majority he gets. I mean, he'll probably get at least 100. If he gets, this is Keir Starmer, if he gets as high as 200 or more, then he's going to have complete control. Mm. And I don't think that's healthy. I don't think that's good for the Labour Party, because they won't be able to have any sort of restraint on what he does. It'll be worse than Blair. So a huge majority for Keir Starmer, I think, would be most unhealthy.
Sittingbourne and Sheppey's current MP, Gordon Henderson, isn't re-standing at the general election, having been an MP for 14 years. How would you rate his performance over that time?
He hasn't really left a great mark. I mean, his most famous moments were when there was a lot of rumours about him defecting to UKIP. Apart from that, I don't think he's troubled the major news stories too much. He's made a big thing about picking up litter. But apart from that...
Dan, you want to come in there, do you?
So I was going to say, you mentioned housing earlier. I wanted to sort of drill down on that, because I spend quite a lot of time at Swale Borough Council, often for the planning committee, which, of course, you chair. And frankly, it seems every time I go, I hear updates from council officers that your council has spent yet more taxpayers' money at the planning inspectorate failing to defend your decision to refuse planning applications. Why is it that Swale Borough Council seems to refuse planning applications all the time, despite, planning officers saying that there's no legitimate reason to?
But do you know how wrong that is? Do you know how absolutely unviable that argument is? Since 2001, we have spent less than £300,000 defending planning appeals.
How many of those have you actually won?
If you win an appeal, you don't get costs.
Yeah, okay.
So the biggest one that we lost was, costs-wise, was Barton Hill on Sheppey. That cost us £135,000. That was largely opposed by the Conservative group. We tended to support them, but they opposed something they'd voted for in the local plan of 2017, and the deviations were pretty minor. So that was the big one. The rest of them are not on average about 4,000 or 5,000, and we have only had to pay costs on 7 appeals. So this whole idea that we are constantly losing appeals and paying a fortune in costs just doesn't stack up. It's what our opposition like to shout it around all the time. So we've just got the figures for them, and it's a fraction of what they've been pretending.
Okay. Mike, I was just going to say to you, you know, that obviously you feel quite passionately about this. I mean, do you think overall, and this is talking about Kent-wide, are there enough houses in Kent? Do we need to build any more houses in Kent?
We need to build houses for local people. What we're doing is having to build houses for Londoners because the London local plan doesn't supply enough housing. London wants to keep building offices and not build housing. So we have to house the overspill from London, which means that the houses that get built are aimed at the London market and our locals are struggling to get on the housing ladder, even though there's all these houses going up. It's an absolutely chronic situation.
But do you think constantly refusing, being sceptical of the amount of housing that's being built and wanting to limit house building helps that? Because, you know, a lot of people say the only way you're going to drive house prices down and make it more accessible for local people is to get more houses built.
Yeah, that's an economic argument that people keep putting forward. It's never worked. Because as soon as profits go down, the developers stop building. So it's absolute fallacy that if you can build your way to cheap housing, you can't.
Well, I mean, do you know anyone building houses for free? Because like, it's clearly not happening. People need to, you know, it's an industry, like it or not, people are going to make money off it.
Of course they are. In the old days, of course, councils could build houses and keep them and not have to sell them off, which, you know, is the current situation.
Okay, would you see a situation where a government, be it a Labour government or another shade of government in the future, sort of saying, OK, well, we don't need to build any more houses in Kent. The only houses that we will build in Kent are ones that people can afford to buy. So if you're local and you need a one-bedroom flat to rent or to buy, we'll give you help to buy it and we'll make the rents affordable for those people. So you're not losing people to other parts of the country. Would you see that as a sort of viable alternative?
Yeah, providing we can then build the jobs that people need, because, you know, the two go hand in hand. When you've got so many of our people doing a four-hour commute every day, because the only jobs, well-skilled jobs, are mainly available in London, then we need to be able to provide those. You need a systems change where we get away from the commuting approach and say more houses in London, more jobs outside. And that way people can start to actually, you know, maybe get to work within half an hour and get a decent job. That's what we would like to see. It shouldn't be that difficult. If housing was based on local need, we would have needed about 7,500 houses when the last local plan went through.
But then do you think
14,500?
But then do you think the obligation of local councils should be, you know, what, just to basically sustain a static population and assume that nobody will ever move there and only build enough houses for the people that are already there?
That's a projection of your future population growth. Mm. But if all councils delivered that, then we would have the housing for the growth, but we would also have it fairly shared out. If the big problem is London, it's just not providing housing for people in London, yet it keeps wanting to build more offices. It's turning everything into offices but not houses. Should be the other way around.
One final thing just before we go, Mike, I've always been intrigued actually, because you're a man with a very distinctive look. And I was saying to one of the older colleagues in the office that you look like you could have played in the Alarm in the early 1980s. Where does that look come from?
I knew his wife, actually. I knew his wife.
Did you?
Yeah. We used to work together in the BUAV, the British Union for the Abolition of Vivisection, around 1990. Where did it come from? It came from the early 80s goth movement.
Okay. Yeah, I'm old enough to remember that. I'm not sure how petty the office was, but
being autistic, I don't change a lot.
How's that sort of shaped your life?
Well, I first mentioned it in 2019 when I became part of the coalition that was running Swale. Previously, I'd always considered that, you know, how I behaved and the reactions, I dealt with them. But when you're part of a team like a cabinet, I knew that sometimes my actions and what I do is going to upset people, and that could reflect on the rest of the cabinet and the leader. Mm. So I let people know then, because there are inevitably going to be issues where there's a meltdown or I don't understand what somebody is saying. So I just mentioned about the Asperger's so that they were ready or understood when it inevitably flared up. Mm. But I've kind of known about it since about 2009. But back then, there was a lot less understanding and a lot less, you know, a lot more discrimination. But for the last 5 years, I've, you know, let people know, and I just want to be able to show people that you can do, you can achieve as an autistic person. You don't have to think that certain areas off limits.
You said that you're Asperger's. For the sake of people listening, can you sort of explain the difference between sort of autism and Asperger's, or how they differ?
Asperger's is no longer recognised medically, but I still use it because it gives people an idea. Asperger's is part of the autistic spectrum, but there's many different ways that people are autistic. Different things that come forward, different symptoms. So it's hard when you say autistic for the person hearing it to fully comprehend what that means. There is still there's a vague idea about Asperger's that conveys something more specific. So I tend to use that. But yeah, it just means that sometimes you might totally freeze because you're confused about what someone's saying, or you might pick on the wrong aspect of what someone's saying and totally lose it.
Has that in any way sort of hampered you in politics? I have on occasion seen you kind of lose your rag in the council chamber, Kent County Council. Are those moments when you have maybe sort of displayed those autistic traits?
That's just utter disgust at what's going on. I have had meltdowns. I tend to leave a room if I can feel that I'm about to be triggered. Sometimes you can't tell and it breaks out. But sometimes you just get understandably angry and frustrated at what is going on when you're hearing absolute pish.
Okay, listen, Mike, it's been lovely to speak to you. Thank you very much indeed for your time.
And you.
Good luck in the general election.
Cheers. Bye.
Thanks to everyone for joining me on this week's podcast. We'll be back next week when we'll be having a chat with Martin Baxter, one of the boffins behind the political polling website Electoral Calculus. He'll be crunching the numbers and telling us what the state of play is in Kent ahead of a general election. You can follow us on X, formerly Twitter. Just search for Kent Politics Podcast. Also, don't forget to tune into KMTV at 5 p.m. each Friday for their politics show. All the best now.
Thanks for listening to the Kent Politics Podcast. Don't forget to check out stories throughout the week on the politics page of Kent Online. And you can watch the Kent Politics Show with Rob Bailey on KMTV every Friday at 5 p.m. or on demand at kmtv.co.uk.
This has been an I Am Listening original podcast. For more information, head over to our website, iam-listening.co.uk.